Chad Hundley is on vacation. I'm David Brinkley, NBC News. The earthquake in Peru on Sunday struck about half the country, causing devastation. Then, as a result of the shaking, the dams around a lake high in the Andes collapsed, and the water poured down the mountainsides and washed away two towns, each with a population of about 40,000. A Peruvian government official said the towns, Ungay and Caras, had simply disappeared. Now, cracks have appeared in some of the mountains, among the highest in Latin America, and they're afraid they might come sliding down.
The film received so far of the after effects of the Peruvian earthquake is understandably skimpy and hastily shot. This film was seen originally on television in Lima, the Peruvian capital, and it does at least give you some idea of the catastrophe. The earthquake and the avalanches and floods that followed it are now described as the largest natural disaster Peru has ever suffered. If the most pessimistic forecasts are borne out, they will combine into one of the largest natural disasters the world has ever known. Obviously, however, what we are seeing here are, relatively speaking, the mildest effects of the earthquake along its fringes. The places that were hardest hit are still largely cut off, or in some cases, it appears from aerial observation, wiped out. To repeat, these are the victims, some dead, some surviving, of the earthquake in Peru on Sunday that hit a large area about 300 miles northeast of Lima. Some help is getting through to these people, governmental and private. Peruvian paratroopers and paramedics dropped in, help from Argentina, Brazil, and Chile, and from the United States, which has sent transport planes, rescue teams, and helicopters. New details of the disaster reached Lima today. It appears that two towns, Ungay and Caras, were swept away when the earthquake smashed the dams on a lake high in the Andes. Pilots who flew over the area reported clouds of dust to an altitude of 18,000 feet. How many survived is not known, for there is no way to tell. There is also concern about the possibility of further landslides. The pictures in the wake of earthquakes tend to be familiar. Refugees, cracks in the road, here more than a crack, a ditch. And again, the refugees, dazed, but making feeble attempts to carry on. Then there are those who sleep the sleep of exhaustion. And there are those who sleep but will never wake. The candles are stuck into soft drink bottles. The gesture is to that extent informal, but still final. Edwin Newman, NBC News, reporting.
The president is sending a delegation or task force to Southeast Asia to view the military operations there and then to report back to him. The group includes members of Congress, the White House staff, and three governors. Virtually all of them are supporters of the war. Senator Church of Idaho predicted they would be carefully herded through selected prearranged places, and he said those chosen to go have already made up their minds. Tomorrow, the Senate will vote on an amendment saying the president may continue military operations in Cambodia so long as even one American is held prisoner there. Opponents said that would prolong the war indefinitely and would not save a single prisoner. But the issue is an emotional one, difficult for senators to vote against.
Starting from the east bank of the twisting Mekong River, a South Vietnamese armored brigade headed north from Highway 1. It was a well-coordinated drive. While the armor drove north and prepared to turn westward, a massive gunboat flotilla churned up the Mekong River. These ships would serve as a blocking force, the other arm of the pincer, to prevent the communists from crossing the Mekong in the direction of Phnom Penh. American naval vessels stayed with the flotilla until it reached the line beyond which President Nixon has commanded that no U.S. forces can go. The U.S. boats fell back, but the South Vietnamese gunboats steamed on, some of them all the way to Phnom Penh. Surprised Cambodians in the city stood on the riverbank and watched the South Vietnamese go by. At this point, it was going well. The communists were caught trying to move weapons by ox carts. The haul, made north of Prey Veng, totaled 1,600 weapons.
It's one of the biggest sweeps and one of the deepest penetrations into Cambodia. This is John Rich, NBC News, with the South Vietnamese Armored Column in Cambodia.
In addition to the South Vietnamese columns and gunboats, there are other forces at work in Cambodia which have totally changed the situation in this once nearly neutral part of Indochina. This is what Cambodia looked like militarily at the end of April, just before the American attacks began. The enemy sanctuaries along the border then were being attacked sporadically by South Vietnamese troops, and the port of Sihanoukville had already been closed to the communists by Prince Sihanouk, now deposed. And now, at the beginning of June, this is what the situation looks like in Cambodia. The Americans are withdrawing. There is speculation that the president tomorrow night will announce some troop withdrawals. The South Vietnamese are, as we have seen, spreading through the countryside and along the Mekong River. Thailand, to the west, traditional enemies of the Cambodians, has announced that it is sending volunteers. The enemy, North Vietnamese and Viet Cong, driven out of the sanctuaries, is redeploying in northern and western Cambodia and along the Mekong River. Pathet Lao troops, along with the North Vietnamese, are moving from Laos into Cambodia. The Pathet Lao are the communist forces in Laos. The Cambodians have tried to set up a defense line around the capital of Phnom Penh, although no one is sure they will fight, and American and South Vietnamese naval units have set up a sort of blockade 70 miles off the coast of Cambodia. In short, in Cambodia, everything has now changed. The place is a true battleground of this war.
Last year, Captain Robert Marasco and seven other Green Berets in Vietnam were accused of murdering a spy or a counter-spy or something like that, never made clear. Later, the U.S. government decided not to put them on trial. Well, now, Captain Marasco, out of the Army, says if they had tried the case, it would have embarrassed the government, the CIA, and he says it would have exposed incompetency in the military. Marasco is interviewed tonight on NBC's program, First Tuesday.
If he was talking with Viet Cong, that would be very indicative, I think, because he always contended that, first of all, there were no Viet Cong in Cambodia, and there were no North Vietnamese in Cambodia. Then when he admitted that possibly they were there, he certainly didn't condone them being there and would just as soon them have left. If he were contacting them and working with them, then that sheds another light on it.
Being realistic, would you think that Sihanouk would go out and openly talk to VC commanders or VC political officers in Cambodia?
No, he wouldn't openly do that. That's why I had had agents working for me.
What did they report? That he did?
Yes.
Do you think it's possible that a man like Sihanouk could have been deposed by his own generals just on their own, or have you ever thought that there was some other thing involved in what happened to Sihanouk?
I don't doubt that there was some other thing involved in him being deposed. Possibly his generals were strong enough and had enough support to do it on their own, but as I said, I don't doubt that other people had something to do with it.
Like who?
Oh, like other governments, other intelligence organizations.
American or South Vietnamese or both?
Both.
A resolution introduced in the Senate asks President Nixon to try to persuade the Russians to withdraw their people from Egypt. The resolution's sponsors said Israel was much more important to the U.S. than Vietnam. This afternoon, Secretary of State Rogers called in the Russian ambassador and asked him just what they were up to in the Middle East. And the State Department said his answers were vague and unsatisfactory.
Ambassador Dobrynin came to the State Department at Secretary Rogers' request. Dobrynin returned recently from a six-week stay in Moscow when the United States wanted to know if he had brought back any new Soviet positions on the Middle East. Apparently, he had not. The meeting lasted only 40 minutes. Rogers emphasized the U.S. views the situation as very serious, and he pressed Dobrynin for some clarification of Soviet intentions in the Middle East in view of their escalating military involvement, which now includes Russian pilots and thousands of technicians in Egypt. The Soviets' response to the question about their intentions is a key element in the administration's pending decision on whether or not to sell Israel more American jets. Afterwards, U.S. officials declined to characterize the nature of today's meeting. They said both sides agreed on the need for renewed efforts to achieve a political settlement, and they agreed to meet again next week. But it was obvious that Dobrynin did not clarify Soviet intentions, and the Russian response to that key question remains imprecise and unsatisfactory. Richard Valeriani, NBC News at the State Department.
Two very different people gave their views on the war and the economy. Thomas J. Watson, board chairman of IBM, before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he said the war was the major factor in turning a healthy economy into an unhealthy one, and he said the longer the U.S. stays in Vietnam, the more chaotic this country will become. He said the damage already done will take decades to repair, and he thought we might soon reach the point where much of it will be beyond repair. And Nathaniel Goldfinger, economist for the AFL-CIO, said the country was being pushed into a deepening recession that could go even further, into a recession. He said there was the worst inflation in 20 years, the biggest rise in unemployment in 10 years, and the highest interest rates in 100 years.
Christy Smothers is only 9 months old, but already she spent more time in hospitals than many adults do in a lifetime. Christy's had four operations. She will have to have at least one more to correct a congenital defect in her urinary tract.
It's nice to see you, Mr. Smothers, and it's nice to see you too, Christy.
In just the short time that Christy has been in and out of hospitals, her father, Claude, has watched the hospital costs go up. Insurance will cover most expenses, but still the Smothers will have to pay $3,000 or $4,000 on their own. They are of moderate means. They live in a small but comfortable home in a suburb south of Chicago. They have three older children. Smothers was floored when he found out what his medical costs would be. He is having difficulty meeting the bills.
The hospitalization costs exceed $2,000 each time she goes in. In addition, we have the doctor's costs of surgery and other incidental costs of the hospital, drugs and so forth.
What has this done to your budget, having to pay for these hospital costs?
Well, it has pretty well depleted our budget. It has taken all the extra money that we've been able to come up with and put a strain on our whole financial situation. The new rugs that we would have liked to purchase have had to wait. We've become a one-car family instead of a two.
I have to wait for certain things that I would normally go out and just buy without even thinking. Now I have to stop and think, should I spend the money for this, or can we get along without this, and wait and see how much more we're going to need for the cost of the hospital to pay.
What would you do if you didn't have the insurance to fall back on?
That's a hard question to answer.
Do you think you could meet the obligations?
No.
The White House sent two West Point professors ranging around the country studying local welfare programs, and they came back with a report that many are so badly run, the federal government ought to take them over, they said, or strictly supervise them. They are Captains Terrence Goggin and Walter Hendricks. And here's Goggin talking to a Senate committee today.
I was stunned by the experience of driving in a White House limousine to an airport, going on a plane that was air-conditioned in tremendous luxury, landing in Mississippi or Missouri or California, and going off in a car to a shack where children, in my opinion, were literally dying. They were, their minds were dying. This is something that I'll never forget. And just is incredible to me that, you know, you come back to Washington and you try to explain this to somebody else. You say, you must do something about it. And they say, well, yes, we're going to do that, but for now, we've got tremendous budget problems, and the Bureau of the Budget has great difficulties, and we don't know where we're going to get the money. And I say, yes, but people are dying out there. And children are being condemned to totally wasted lives. And it is that type of reaction. I almost wanted to suggest that as a matter of course, as a matter of routine, that staff members in the bureaucracy go take field trips, go out and see the way people are really living in this country. And I think that we would that would have a significant influence on the policies and the priorities this government engages in, and the way it determines those priorities. It's very easy to sit in Washington and devise policies and strategies based upon what you read and not really see the results of what you're doing.
After 4 days of a rising stock market, some traders saw a chance to sell today and make a little money, and they did. Selling for profit-taking was so brisk it ended the market's rise early in the day, but it then picked up again later. It closed with the Dow Jones showing a loss of a fraction of 1 point, but an average share gaining 2 cents. On the American, an average share gained 13 cents. 12 members of the House Banking Committee introduced a bill to give President Nixon the standby power to put on wage and price controls if he wants to. His present position is that he does not want to. There is no news on what happened to two CBS correspondents in Cambodia, Gerald Miller and George Sivertson, and NBC correspondent Wells Hanging. Mikis Theodorakis, who did the music for Zorba the Greek, got out of Greece. He'd been a political prisoner because the government didn't like his views, but they finally let him go, and a French editor took him to Paris, where he is living now.
Mikis Theodorakis spent the last 3 years of his life in Greek jails. Now he's living here in a small apartment on this quiet street in the Latin Quarter of Paris. The man who wrote the music for Zorba the Greek has become the symbol of the Greek resistance movement. Theodorakis is a communist. He believes American military leaders sponsored and directed the military takeover in Greece. He gives the impression of a man of great sincerity and moral stature, of a man who loves his country, of a man who has accepted personal deprivation as the price to be paid for his political beliefs. And after 3 years of imprisonment, he says his new freedom still seems like a dream.
Now that you're a free man, what about your future?
One thing, for a free Greece, I want to give my life, the life of my family, of my parents, my relatives, and all I have, my health, for Greece. I would like Greece really democratic and the people really to be free. Have a constitution, have human rights. Greece is a jungle now. Greece has to be free. Democracy has to be restored in Greece, but a real democracy. Nothing else.
Even though you had no piano or any sort of musical instrument, you managed to compose almost 100 songs. How did you do that?
Well, I began to be a composer when my family had no possibility of having a piano. I also wrote my music without a piano. I made it up in my head with paper. The first time I had a piano was this one here in Paris. In Greece, I didn't have a piano. I was always in exile in 47. In 45, I was at war, and I composed when I was in the army. In 45 and 46, I composed a lot. Afterwards, I was deported to some islands. 47, 48, 49, I was in a concentration camp, and I composed a symphony just like that, on paper.
Would you play some for us? Would you play some for us now?
Oui, si vous voulez. C'est un peu difficile.
What is this one? What is this one about?
It's about my son. On a fouillé un jour les.
One day.
La police.
The police searched us. My son became a little sick after that. And I composed this song.
Good night for NBC News.